welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest is F. William Engdahl, Bill Engdahl. And let me just remind listeners that we have a pretty full week of live programming this week. Ordinarily, we are on at this hour Mondays and Tuesdays live, the rest of the week archived. But we have four live programs this week, today, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Friday. And go to Republic Broadcasting. You can check the schedule or do it on globalresearch.ca. And we want to talk about a very important article that my guest, Bill Engdahl, wrote. He's been on several times before. For listeners who don't know Bill, I hope you all do. But for the ones who don't, Bill is a leading researcher. He's an economist. He's an analyst of the New World Order. Oh, he writes on virtually everything of importance. He writes an awful lot on the economy, on the current economic crisis, and he has two really crucially important books that I've read and wrote something about, and I strongly recommend them to you. They're really timeless. His earlier one is called The Century of War on Oil and Geopolitics, and his most recent one is called Seeds of Destruction, on how the big ag giants want to make all foods GMO and force feed them on us. It really is a very, very disturbing story. And Bill has a new book coming out sometime in 2009, I hope soon. It's called The Power of Money, The Rise and Decline of the American Century. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Oh, it's terrific having you back on again, and we want to talk about your awfully important article that really knocked my socks off when I read it. It's featured on Global Research, up on top. You wrote it mid-December, and you talk about the Federal Reserve setting the stage, possibly, for a Weimar-style hyperinflation. And for listeners who don't know just how bad that was, it doesn't get any worse than that if it happens, where money really isn't worth the paper it's printed on, literally that bad. And we've had terrible policies. They continue. And, Bill, let me just read a little of what you wrote at the end of your article, then you jump in. And you know the drill here. When you hear the music, we've got a commercial coming, and the first one comes up pretty quickly. But you wrote that from August 1929 to when Roosevelt took over, basically, the economy declined 33%. And then there's this statement that ought to get everybody's attention. Barack Obama looks set, I'd add the word possibly, to break the record, to preside over what historians may one day in the future call the very Great Depression of 2008 to 2014. And you talk about how he's got the same cast of characters on board to lead what I wrote about in an article with a question mark on the end called his economic dream team that raised a little bit of attention, the same kind of people that have made terrible mistakes in the past. And you talk about the necessity of having a much different system with different people in charge to conduct vastly different policies than the ones going on now. And it looks to be the same ones that Obama will continue when he takes over in a couple of weeks, and the terrible consequences of what that may mean. Oh, Bill, I'm just breathless thinking about what you wrote, and you're the guy who wrote it, so let me let you take over and talk about it, and then we'll break as soon as we hear that music and come back for a longer segment. I think I hear it.
Let's wait till after the break, then, and I'll...
Let's take a break, come back, and then you explain the terrible threats that we face.
Fine.
To the News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. I'm on with Bill Engdahl. We're talking about the economic crisis. Bill, let me just mention one thing. There is another big story going on in the world that's really gotten my focus very greatly, the crisis in Gaza. That's not the topic of today's program, but there'll be plenty on it for the rest of the week. So again, I urge listeners to tune in tomorrow, Wednesday, and Friday. And you'll get plenty on Gaza and things related to it. But let's get back to the economic crisis. And Bill, let me let you take over and talk about the awfully important material you wrote in your article.
Yeah, well,
I really wish everybody would read this article. It would be a great eye opener for all of them. But you take over and talk about it.
Yeah, let me just go back to September 14th, when the Federal Reserve decided to expand the monetary base and accept for the first time in history corporate assets that were not rated triple A. And what was the significance of that? There was an FOIA disclosure suit that was filed by Bloomberg Finance, the financial news service, back in November, calling for details of what the Fed has done with the $2 trillion that it has been spreading around the financial system. And the Fed said simply, we don't have to disclose this, please go mind your own business, basically. Well, on the 14th of September, the Fed opened the spigots. It's a crude term for what they've done, but what they've done is unprecedented in the 95-year history since the Federal Reserve was created as the private central bank of the United States in 1913. What they did was, number one, as I said, accept securities from banks that weren't rated AAA. That meant the Federal Reserve would take all of this toxic waste and give the banks in return government securities, government treasury bills and bonds and such things that were rated AAA, and also didn't require the banks to set aside any Basel 8% risk set aside in their balance sheets. So they could just sit there and clip coupons and slowly rebuild their balance sheets without lending a penny on to the real economy. So banks are not lending for the most part still in the United States. It's a little bit different in Europe, but let's focus on the U.S. Then why September 14th? Because Bernanke and Tim Geithner, who's going to be the Treasury Secretary under the new Obama presidency, Tim Geithner agreed to this extraordinary measure of the Federal Reserve to soak up all these toxic waste assets from the private banking system to clean up their mess, because they knew that on the 15th of September, Bernanke and the Treasury Secretary Paulson were going to announce that they had let Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment bank, something like a 150-year-long history, go bankrupt, defaulting on untold billions worth of derivatives and other obligations that were held all around the world. And Lehman Brothers wasn't just an upstart hedge fund or a boutique or something like this. This was a 150-year-old investment bank that was considered the fourth largest in the world. It was considered, or the United States, certainly too big to fail if Bear Stearns was rescued by the Treasury and the Federal Reserve some weeks before. And certainly if AIG, an insurance company, which the Federal Reserve has no constitutional jurisdiction over insurance companies, their concern is the banking system. So the decision was made to bail out AIG and then let Lehman Brothers go under. Well, what effect did that have? From Japan to Hong Kong to Singapore to you name it, the entire world was suddenly caught unawares and had no idea what the standard or the criterion was, who was too big to fail and who should be let go. And that put an element of uncertainty in the global financial system. This was the most colossal failure of judgment, probably of any Treasury Secretary and any New York Federal Reserve President in history, and there have been some colossal failures of judgment over the 95 years. So that simply meant that everybody covered his back in the international interbank system and didn't dare to lend to anybody else because they didn't know who was going to disappear the next day and who wasn't. So partly thank that decision by Tim Geithner, Treasury Secretary Designate, and, of course, Henry Paulson, Goldman Sachs's poster child in Washington now, and, of course, the Bush administration and the Congress. The Congress bears an entirely joint share of blame for this fiasco because they had this ideological thing about how we have to let these banks go and teach them a lesson. Well, that isn't the way to do it. When you're in the middle of a crisis, you don't teach lessons. You clean up the mess and contain it as quickly as possible. Then you put people in jail and whatnot, but not at this point of the process. So, but then what the Fed did in the context of that was something like emergency lending of more than $2 trillion as of the middle of November, a rise of 138% in 12 weeks since the failure of Lehman Brothers. Now, in addition to that, they increased what's called the monetary base. Now, this is a little bit technical, but I'll try to simplify it. These are total bank reserves plus cash circulating. And the monetary base increase is the basis for what is called high-powered bank lending into the economy. The monetary base nominally is tiny, but what most people don't realize is that for every dollar the Federal Reserve puts into the bank reserves, private bank reserves, the bank has the potential of an 80-fold multiplier. That's highly geared money. So what is happening? Why haven't we had hyperinflation already? It's because the banks aren't lending. So they're sitting there with these bank reserves on their balance sheets.
Bill, you said 80-fold, 80-fold.
80, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I thought it was more like 10-1, but it's
80-1. No.
That's
something else. Yeah, that's... The Basel bank adequate capital adequacy rules say that for normal commercial lending, industrial and commercial lending, you have to have 8% on your balance sheet for every lending. So that figure comes out to something like 11-1. No, but this so-called bank monetary base lending, it has an 80-fold multiplier, had before the crisis. I don't know how that's changed. Now nobody does.
And you call this unprecedented. The only thing close to it, as you indicated, was in 1939 as we were preparing for World War II.
Yeah, and we've gone way beyond that level. We've gone way beyond that. So that in 39, the increase of the monetary base was 28% in September in the credit issuance by the government for the war build-up to factories and so forth. The first week of December, the monetary base surged a rate of 76% in the previous 3 months. So it's just out of control. Now, the thing to understand is nothing has happened yet because the banks are holding on to that money. They're terrified to lend into this economy. It's sinking like a stone. But at some point, maybe it takes 12 months, maybe it takes 18 months, the banks will slowly come back into lending when they think they've cleaned up the worst of their mess, and that money is going to come into the economy, and that is going to trigger what I see as a likely Weimar-style or Germany-style hyperinflation.
Bill, let me ask you to explain one other thing, which, as a non-economist, is not entirely clear to me. I know the term, but maybe you can explain it in layman's terms so I understand it better and listeners. You talk about how the Fed also, in an unprecedented act, created all of this new money but did not sterilize it. Explain exactly what that means and why there's a great danger in that.
Well, when they increase the monetary base, they have been, up until September, they have been so-called sterilizing it. That means it doesn't have an effect on the real economy. It's a technical term, but they, in a sense, ensure that it doesn't enter into the cash flow of the real economy. But this time, they threw caution to the winds because they're so desperate, and they didn't sterilize it. And that means that the banks have that on their books, technically, and when they decide to lend, that's going to have this huge hyperinflationary shock effect. Now, what the Fed can do something to counter that, the Fed can, of course, raise interest rates, but you can imagine the Fed raising interest rates the minute the economy struggles to come out of this. Keep in mind, Steve, that the 1929-1938 Great Depression had several waves, it was like a roller coaster up to the peak of the stock market in August of 29, the crash in October 29, down through the bottom in 1931, then a slight recovery because certain things happened that made business a little bit more optimistic, so there was a slight recovery of the stock market. Business confidence started to come back. Then FDR came in with a series of measures to what the business community saw and the banks saw as socializing the American economy, and they didn't know what was going to happen with the National Recovery Administration and all these various new programs that Roosevelt was introducing. So there was another collapse of confidence, and then it went up and down like that until, and then 36, 37, the Fed prematurely thought, just like they did in Japan 10 years ago, that the worst was over, and they started raising interest rates, and it went, the market crashed again. So that's the kind of thing that we can expect in this, not a recovery that the worst is over, it's a typical post-war recession. No, this is going to be, as I say, a very great depression.
And this could go on for a good number of years.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Bill Engdahl. We're talking about the economic crisis and Bill's article on the Federal Reserve setting the stage possibly for a Weimar-style hyperinflation. Bill, you also quote your friend John Williams, and he'll be on this program later in January to pick up where you leave off and talk more about what's going on in his views. And he's certainly written an awful lot about hyperinflation. And you mentioned that he's about the only one who's given a good definition of a recession versus a depression versus a great depression and the possibility of a very great depression in your language. Mm-hmm. But he talks about a depression being the economy or the GDP dropping 10% and a great depression, the economy, the GDP dropping 25%.
Yeah.
And you talk about the possibility that we could be, if we don't get some good people doing good things, enacting good policies, then we could be in for something far greater than the past Great Depression. That's very scary stuff.
Well, let me add to that a little bit, Steve, if I may. The John has had something called shadow government statistics. I've known him for about a quarter of a century, and he is about the only person I know who's taken the care to actually look way back in the 1980s. He was doing this tracking down what was the accepted definition from the National Bureau of Economic Research, who officially declares a recession begun or ended. For some peculiar reason, a private think tank up in Cambridge, Massachusetts does that. But the what he found is that since the Great Depression ended, and after World War II, the government just wiped out of its economic lexicon the word depression as something that was a once in a history of mankind event, and that only recessions were possible because of all the new innovations that have been created, Social Security, these shock absorbers in the economy, and so forth. So as John points out, that's pure hogwash, but Hoover presided over 43 months of a contraction of the economy after the stock market crash in 29 when he left office and Roosevelt took over in 33. And there the economy dropped 33%. I think what we're going to see coming in the next 3 to 5 years, and this is a process under the best of terms, and you have the worst of people possible for overseeing this in terms of the dream team economics crew, but under the best of circumstances, with people who were utterly dedicated to the good of the nation and the population, not to the good of the Wall Street financial system, you're going to have probably 10 years to come out of this thing. So people better buckle their seatbelts and get ready for pure hell. And this is the tragedy of this criminal insanity of the Wall Street institutions over the last 10 or 15 years. You can trace it back further, but that's another topic. The let's look at who this dream team is. Number one, you have as senior economic advisor, none other than Paul Volcker, the protege of David Rockefeller at Chase Manhattan Bank, who was brought down in 1979 by orders of David Rockefeller to his Trilateral Commission underling, Jimmy Carter. And he told Carter that he had to accept Volcker as the Federal Reserve Chairman. Volcker immediately in October 79 implemented the famous Volcker shock therapy, where interest rates shot up 300% in relative terms in a matter of months. That triggered the Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s. That triggered the crisis in Poland and Yugoslavia and many other countries in Eastern Europe that had borrowed on floating interest rates. And Paul Volcker put the U.S. economy up until the summer of 1982 through the worst post-war recession in American history. So he's not exactly the kind of person I would want to have operating on this patient. This is like having Dr. Caligari with the surgeon's knife. But add to that Larry Summers, who was number two under Robert Rubin during the whole Asia crisis and Mexico peso crisis in the early and mid-90s. And what Larry Summers did in those situations, or supervising the policy that encouraged the dot-com bubble and later collapse, is also hardly any grounds for confidence. And Tim Geithner signed on to the, he may have had private doubts, but he signed on to the September 14th decision with Bernanke and Paulson to let Lehman Brothers go, that detonated the intensity of this crisis. It's brought the largest three automakers in the United States to their knees. Nobody can buy cars because banks don't give consumer loans anymore. They're terrified of snowballing defaults in that area, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And,
Bill Geithner is important because he's head of the New York Fed, the most important Federal Reserve Bank.
Yeah.
So he's the guy who was in the middle of all this, the head of the New York Fed. Sits right in the middle.
Yeah. And he's now going to be the Treasury Secretary. So there's a complicating thing, though, that I'd like to throw out so people are realistic about what they face and make decisions based on reality and not based on wishful thinking. There is something called the Baby Boomer Generation Retirement Wave that's about to kick in around 2011, 2012, 2013.
Okay, can I get you to hold that thought one second?
I'll hold that, the demographic component.
Yeah, we'll come right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman, on with Bill Engdahl. Bill, before you pick it up, let me just make a quick comment. A listener called in and mentioned that he sees no signs of a recession. Well, I guess he doesn't follow the economic data. That's some of the worst in half a century or more. I mean, the economic data is absolutely abysmal. GDP is plunging. Unemployment is skyrocketing. Millions of people are losing their homes. I would say that's a pretty clear sign of recession, a pretty severe recession, Bill, but you pick it up.
Yeah. Well, the point I started to make is that whatever the detritus is of this securitization debacle that Wall Street and Alan Greenspan fostered over the past decade, that may take 8 or 10 years to clean up, but we have on top of that a unique demographic crisis that is about to hit in 2 to 3 years big time, and that is that the baby boomer generation, the so-called generation that exploded onto the scene with a great fecundity back in the period after World War II from 1945 until approximately 65 is the dating of the baby boom generation. Well, that large bubble in the population pyramid has been working its way through like a pig being swallowed by an anaconda, or however you want to imagine it. And they have been the main factor driving the stock market boom since 1982 or the early 1980s until approximately 2007, early 2008. And with the hiccups in between of the dot-com collapse and recovery and so forth, but basically that's been an upward trend. Because the net capital inflows or cash inflows into the market from the retirement savings, the 401ks and so forth of the boomer generation was what was driving the stock market. So you could play all sorts of games as an investment broker, stock broker, or whatever you want to do, or hedge fund on that background reality. Well, now we're going to come into a period. We've had a 30 to 40% crash in the S&P 500, in the Dow, and so forth over the past, the NASDAQ, over the past 12 months. But what's going to come now is not going to be a booming recovery, not in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, because the baby boomer generation that's going to start in large numbers cashing in their stock holdings to live, simply to live, and they're going to find that they're the value of their 401ks that they thought was going to see them through to a comfortable retirement, that's gone by half or by three quarters, and they're going to get in a little bit of a panicky mood. So you have that. You have, instead of an inflow of capital into that as well as into Social Security, that's the cause for the cosmetic shenanigans that every administration since Lyndon Johnson has been doing with the Social Security Trust Fund, counting that as cash flow of the government when it's a trust fund for future retirees. Well, that trust fund has been positive in a huge amount since the Clinton era. That's one reason that Clinton could boast about turning the budget into a surplus for the first time in X number of years. But Larry Summers, it's not his genius, it's pure demographics. Now that, about 1912, 1913, is going to start to be a net drain on both the financial markets, the stock market, the bond market, and on the Social Security. So you're going to have huge government deficits. You're going to have a collapsing stock market. As you pointed out, Steve, you have companies already just walking away from their legal 401k obligations to their employees, saying tough luck. And if the big three go into bankruptcy, you're going to come out of that bankruptcy with workers who spent their whole life working hard for General Motors or Ford or Chrysler, and only find out that the bankruptcy court judge, a good old boy Republican, has decided that the pension obligations are a luxury and to cancel those so the company can continue operation, just like with the airlines. So the prospects are absolutely horrendous, which is why I say the only thing conceivably that could turn this thing around is not a few better people around Obama, but is an approach to the scale of this crisis, looking 10, 20 years ahead, and putting the entire USA Incorporated into a Chapter 11 kind of bankruptcy reorganization, where the banks would take write-offs up to 90% or haircuts up to 90% on their toxic assets, not the taxpayer, but the banks. And the banking system would have to be de facto nationalized. It should have been nationalized like they did in Sweden in 1991 or 92, when they had a similar real estate-based banking crisis. And then the state could sort out the good loans and the bad loans, the good bank, bad bank kind of model, and allow the economy to function, because normal people want to work. They're skilled. Everything is there. They have the machinery, the basis of a functioning economy, agriculture, but they lack the credit. That's what's has the cancer. So you've got to somehow bring this thing under. The only agency that can do this is the federal government. And to do that, you would have to bring the Federal Reserve, as they did in England during World War II, bring the Federal Reserve, like the Bank of England, into the hands of the state. It's a private entity now, and its interest, its constituency, is the private banks, not the American people. For all the rhetoric of Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, he has no concern for the welfare of the nation, except insofar as it helps the private banks and what they ask of him.
Bill, as a non-economist, I look at it a little bit this way. We got ourselves into a colossal debt problem. We've got to find a way to solve this debt problem. But what's going on is the Fed and the Treasury are simply adding colossal more amounts of debt to the already enormous debt problem. And a simple analogy in my mind is to think of trying to treat an alcoholic by giving him more alcohol. He may feel good for a short time, but in the end, the hangover will be that much greater. How on earth do you solve a debt problem by taking on colossal more amounts of debt?
Yeah, you have to freeze all this. You have to declare a moratorium, and that's why you have to put the private banking system in, federalize it, nationalize it, whatever word you want to use.
And they don't want to do it. They'll be socialistic in terms of giving away trillions of our tax dollars to the banks, to whoever else they want to give it to.
It's called banker socialism. You socialize the liabilities, the losses on the taxpaying population, and you privatize the profits to the banks.
Oh, indeed.
Banker socialism.
Indeed. But they won't do the obvious thing. And you've written about what went on in Sweden that resulted in a couple of very, very painful years. But they did the right thing, and they cleaned up this system. They separated the good parts of their banks from the bad parts. They cleaned it up in a couple of very painful years, and they came out of it in a very healthy state. And we are not doing that.
Well, the Federal Reserve actually looked again at that Securum model in Sweden in 92, and in preparing for the worst before this Lehman Brothers fiasco in September. But it was shouted down by Paulson, the Treasury, and the Senate, the White House. They didn't want to have anything to do with, as Paulson put it, that's not the American way of doing things.
Oh, my goodness. Why the Senate? I mean, they don't know anything about economics.
They know about ideology.
They know about politics.
Well, they don't know about politics, but they know about ideology, and they play, play to voter bases. For example, one analysis I saw, excuse me, I just got something in my throat here.
Oh, you want to grab a drink of water?
The refusal of Southern senators, Republican Southern senators, to accept any bailout for the big three auto industry was largely being driven by the most parochial state interests, because in the southern states you have non-labor, non-trade union states, right-to-work states to this day. And the senators that opposed this bailout saw a chance to build up their states as the replacement for the northern Detroit automobile industry. So that's another factor that that is influencing this kind of this political petty ideology. That's just the whole thing has become dysfunctional.
Oh, I agree, Bill. I think there's more to this auto thing too that really worries me greatly, and it should organize labor. To me, I see it. I see something coming out of this, where the unions that have already given up so much will be forced to give up a lot more, and then whatever comes out of future negotiations with the auto workers will be a precursor for all of organized labor. I see very dark times ahead for organized labor in the country. They're going to lose
out. Since the Reagan years, and they're going to get darker, I think.
It's going to get a lot darker than the Reagan years, and I mean they'll lose their pensions, their 401ks, they'll lose their benefits. I wrote about the last negotiation between the UAW and the Big Three. It was really a terrible shafting of the workers, and you know they sell it. You know it's either this or we're going out of business, and you'll have nothing. And somehow they managed to after a lot of rank and file opposition. They managed to get the darn thing passed.
Yeah.
But I think whatever is left, I think they want to get rid of it all now, so the workers will end up with nothing.
What this is,
and then take it to all organized labor.
Yeah. What this is, if your listeners want to get an historical perspective, because that's useful in times like this, beginning about 1973, the Rockefeller family, the David Rockefeller of Chase Manhattan Bank, Nelson Rockefeller, and especially John D. Rockefeller III, who wrote a book called The Second American Revolution, they concluded that it was time to begin to roll back the concessions given to working people back in the Great Depression. Back then, you had an active labor movement. You had the AFL-CIO, or the CIO, really explosively organizing across the country. And Roosevelt was shrewd enough to make a coalition with that, as well as with the Communist Party USA, by the way, many Americans don't know that, to co-opt this thing into the establishment's long-term agenda to prepare for World War II. And that's what got the U.S. economy out of the Depression, not anything Roosevelt did under the New Deal. But I just get a little bit tired of all this Roosevelt romantic that you see floating around. The point about this is that what we're facing now is the only analogy in American history is the 1930s experience, and the only way the United States got out of the 1930s was a war, de facto a war of conquest. America doesn't like to call itself an empire. The Council on Foreign Relations and bodies such as that that form foreign policy since World War I consciously did not choose to call it the American Empire. It was called the Defender of Democracy and Free Trade after World War II. But in fact, de facto, it was an empire every bit as effectively, even though it was an informal empire of finance that they created under Bretton Woods in 1944. So the ominous thing I see now is that factions of the establishment are saying the two pillars we've had for American power since World War II have been Wall Street and New York as the financial metropole of the entire world, and that has been the mainstay of American power, being able to influence capital flows and the dollar's reserve currency. That now is in a terminal crisis. The dollar is probably going to lose its percentage roll over and above to the euro and other Asian currencies over the next 3 to 5 years dramatically. And therefore, there is growing thinking among the establishment, 100% the case, that the only other weapon we have is the U.S. military hegemony as the largest military superpower on the planet, full spectrum dominance. By the way, Steve, the next book that I have coming out is actually not The Power of Money, which will be out sometime in the early summer or late spring, but Full Spectrum Dominance, Totalitarian Democracy and the New World Order.
Oh, my goodness, I didn't know about that one, Bill. When
yeah, well,
one
maybe
out?
We can talk about that another time.
Indeed, absolutely.
Do you have a military component?
Do you have a publishing date on that?
Well, I'm doing self-publishing, and I'm aiming for the middle to late February. So.
Oh, and you will alert us when it comes out.
Yeah, well, we should talk about it beforehand just so that people know and they're alerted to when it does come out, because it's very important to be aware of some of these things that most Americans don't have a clue what's behind them,
in
Georgia.
Oh, let me just say this. I mean, we'll set up a tentative date right now to get you back on the program to talk about the book.
Yeah.
So when it's out,
Let's try to talk about it the end of January, early February, and then the book should be out within a matter of 2 weeks plus.
Oh, wonderful. And we can pick a date. I mean, we can pick a date well in advance.
Yeah.
We could do it mid-February, late February, whatever is good for you, Bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would just repeat again to listeners, when I see one of your articles up on Global Research, I absolutely jump to it. Your articles and Michelle Chosudovsky's, when they pop up on the website, I basically drop everything and read those articles, because the two of you write the most important stuff I read, and I really want to urge listeners to get very familiar with globalresearch.ca if you're not already, and my co-host will be back, fairly shortly, hosting programs again. And Bill, we're on 5 days a week, so we have latitude to add extra programs. Mm-hmm. I added two extra ones this week, and I'm looking to add more. I'm pretty busy like you are, but there's so much important going on that I just want to spread the word more. But we can get you on in February, and we'll talk about this book.
Very good.
And your thought before we jumped on that. I forget where we broke
well,
up.
Well, basically the point I was leading up to when I mentioned the Full Spectrum Dominance book is that the second pillar of U.S. global power projection since World War II has been the military hegemony or military dominance. And that is becoming very rapidly the only lever of power projection left to the establishment. So I think when people like Colin Powell and Joe Biden in the campaign said the first 100 days of Obama's presidency are going to be a time of testing unlike anything any president has seen before, a huge international crisis that he's going to have to deal with, I think perhaps they're picking up some rumblings from the tom-toms of the Council on Foreign Relations or Bilderberg or whatever chats that they've been involved in recently, and that some people are preparing a nasty series of military actions to maybe a new Pearl Harbor, who knows, but that a militarization of the U.S. economy, we're already bringing troops back from Iraq and stationing them together with the state police and local police across America. I mean, that's not what the military was for.
It's very, very scary. I've written a little bit about it. We have an awful lot to be worried about. We're going to take another break. Welcome back to the NewsHour for our final segment. Bill, for people who don't know what full-spectrum dominance means, I've written a paragraph or two about it from time to time. It basically means control over everything, land, sea, space, the depths of the oceans, all information, the works. I mean, total control over everything that's going on.
Yep.
And I agree with you that we're debasing the currency, so maybe it's heading into the trash bin. And our one bottom line trump card is our military might. And when all else fails, maybe unleash it somewhere. That worries me, too. I'm very scared of something.
You know, there's an upside and a downside to this, because right now they've got, I think, whom the gods would destroy first they make mad. And we have a country with an elite that has literally lost their grip on reality, I think. And so they just keep driving in full forward. People like Dick Cheney and, you know, the various people, Paulson, Wall Street, and so forth, they just go in full forward. They can't believe it that the magic has gone, that the mandate from heaven has gone from the American century. And this is a result of policies going back to the early 1970s at the very most recent, but certainly that far back. And, you know, it's the chickens are coming home to roost. Unfortunately, hundreds and millions of innocent Americans are going to be made the victim of their madness. But, you know, if you think about it in realistic terms, there are more people who are on the losing side of this thing than the one-tenth of 1% who are sitting at the top and trying to orchestrate and control the world. And that is a basic wellspring of optimism, I think, for the survival of mankind, that people, yep, once they realize that, they'll just begin to think about things differently.
Bill, we're almost out of time. Make a quick comment on the possibility that the rest of the world, the big powers, Russia, China, the EU, may be a little bit fed up with what's going on.
Oh, they are. They're more than fed up. They're going through a huge reassessment of the relationship with the dollar and relationship with the U.S. The Chinese at the last bilateral summit with Paulson, they more or less gave Paulson a lecture on how the U.S. has to get its house in order financially, and that they see that this crisis was made in America.
And it's dragging them down.
Well,
we're going down,
they're taking action.
Down.
Now, they're not burdened by the kind of ideological nonsense that people like Senator Shelby and people in the White House with this radical free market that Uber Alles kind of thinking. But they're determined to stabilize the labor force in China and keep economic growth going in the 8 to 11% levels that it has been in the last 10 years. So they're doing, I'm fairly confident on China. And they're also, Russia's got some very serious problems, but they're dollar-related problems, and they're going to have to make some hard choices as well.
But the EU?
First of all, let me say that I see an inevitable drawing together of China, Russia, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries of Central Asia. And that's the Eurasian landmass that is the constant threat that people like Brzezinski worry about. And in that context, the EU really has little option but to make a decision. Right now they're paralyzed politically, but to make a decision whether their future lies long-term in cooperation with Russia, with China, and Central Asia, or in playing games with NATO and the U.S. While the U.S. economy goes down the tubes. So I think that's going to be a rough process in terms of the European decision, but they're already acting independently from U.S. Direction on this financial crisis.
Well, that may be the big hope, that these other powers will decide they want no more of this nonsense.
Yeah.
And our military cannot take them all on a one-time bill.
Yeah.
Bill, we're out of time. That music means that the top of the hour is coming up. Please let me know.
Well, I'm glad we could take time to do this, Steve.
Oh, Bill, I want you to come on anytime because you talk.